May the words of my lips and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. The baptism of Jesus is a big deal. The New Testament does not leave us in doubt on that score. The baptism is depicted in all four Gospels, which is a less frequent occurrence with Gospel narratives than you may realize. Even something as basic as the story behind Christmas, the story of Christ's birth, that story is found in only two of the Gospels. But his baptism is found in all four with some fairly intriguing variations along the way, including the way in which the climactic moment in the story, the moment of revelation when the voice rings out from heaven. Among the most intriguing variations is the way that climactic moment is handled by each of the evangelists. In the case of Mark, generally regarded as the oldest of the four Gospels, in the case of Mark, we learn that it is Jesus who sees the heavens open, that Jesus sees the Spirit descending like a dove, and that the voice which comes from heaven is addressed to Jesus in a highly personal way. You are my beloved Son. With you I am well pleased. Matthew, in his account, provides a bit of a variation. On the one hand, we again learn through Matthew that Jesus is the one who sees the heavens open and sees the Spirit descending. On the other hand, in Matthew, the heavenly announcement appears to be directed not so much at Jesus, but at those who witness the event. This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Now, for its part, the fourth gospel, John's gospel, chooses quite predictably to go its own way, presenting the baptism through the Baptist's eyes, with the Baptist providing a testimony concerning the baptism. A baptism which is depicted not in real time, but as an occurrence from the past. In the Baptist's testimony, there's no voice from heaven. But what we do learn is that the Baptist himself is prepared to claim that at the time he baptized Jesus, I saw the Spirit descend from heaven like a dove, and it remained on him. In short, what matters in John's gospel is not that the Spirit may have been recognized by Jesus, not that it may have been recognized by others in the crowd, but that the Spirit was recognized by the baptizer himself, who was prepared to offer his testimony. Well, finally, we come to this morning's account taken from Luke's gospel. Luke's account, not surprisingly, is closer to Mark and Matthew than it is to John. Luke, for his part, leaves ambiguous who it was who actually saw the Spirit descend. He chooses to simply state it as an objective fact. The Holy Spirit descended on him in bodily form like a dove. And then, as was true of Mark's account, the voice from heaven is addressed in a highly personal way to Jesus. You are my beloved Son, with you I am well pleased. The bottom line, I suppose, is that this episode in all four Gospels, for whatever difference there is, in all four Gospels, this episode serves as an early validation of Christ's identity, his identity as the chosen one of God. Incidentally, that's one of the reasons why our singing a handful of Christmas carols this morning is not entirely inappropriate, despite the fact that Jesus' baptism takes place roughly 30 years after his birth. From earliest times, there's always been a temptation in the church to think of Christ's baptism as the moment in which he truly becomes the Son of God. In effect, the moment at which God adopts Christ as his Son. There's even a fancy name for that heresy. It's called adoptionism. The church over the centuries has strongly rejected that view, insisting that while Christ's baptism represents an early moment in which his identity is confirmed, that the identity that we claim for him is there from the moment of his birth, indeed, from the moment of his conception. Now, that's not a debate you'll be glad to hear we need to engage this morning. I have no intention of throwing the adoptionists out of the room. However, what I hope will occupy us this morning is Christ's status as the beloved Son, as the one on whom the Spirit descends, as Son of God and God the Son. In short, his status as the chosen one of God. I want to spend some time pondering that phrase and that somewhat loaded word, chosen. And I want us to do so in part because it echoes the phrase that has floated around the Jewish people for centuries, as early as the time of Jesus. There's no getting away, I think, from the connection between the traditional self-understanding of the Jewish people as the chosen people and the traditional self-understanding of Christians who regard themselves as followers of the chosen one. While it's certainly safe to say that regarding Jesus as the chosen one has tended during the time of Christianity's ascendance in the West, and that's for 1500 or 1600 years, while that's tended to cause less misunderstanding and frankly less offense than the notion of the Jews as the chosen people, I think it's fair to suggest that in the postmodern world we inhabit, in the postmodern world in which we live, the whole notion of Jesus as God's chosen one can in fact prove highly offensive to many people. And of course, I realize full well the talk of modernity and postmodernity is a terrific way to encourage a congregation to take a 20-minute nap. But I actually think those words have something important and something meaningful to teach us about the challenge the church faces, the challenge congregations like ours face in the opening decades of the 21st century as we try to be faithful, as we try to be faithful to the gospel of Jesus Christ. To put the matter simply, perhaps overly simply, modernity refers to the world that modern science helped to bring about, a world in which many of the truth claims of the gospel are contested because the gospel makes claims that cannot be verified one way or the other through the means by which science generally chooses to verify a truth claim. The modern impulse, in short, is the impulse that leaves us with the impression that the only things to which we ought to give credence are things that can be measured, things that can be tested under rigorous conditions that prevent subjective considerations from coloring and distorting our findings. That, in a nutshell, is what we mean when we speak of modernity. Now, to turn to postmodernity, first and foremost, is not to claim that the issues raised by modernity are somehow behind us, no longer relevant to us. On the contrary, we all know people. Some of us likely have such a few people in our own family, and I suspect many of us have a couple of those people in our own psyches who consider the claims of the gospel to be nonsense because their understanding of science has convinced them that such claims simply cannot be real, cannot be true. That's a challenge we continue to face in the 21st century, no less than people in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries were facing those same challenges. This is not new. This has roots. However, under the conditions of postmodernity, And this may have something to do with the shrinking world we live in. People question not only the truthfulness of the gospel claims, but what is seen to be the particularity of the gospel claims. The issue for postmoderns is that the claims made by the gospel appear to be not so much false, but presumptuous. Who are we to insist that the story of Jesus holds universal significance? Who are we to maintain that Jesus is not only a chosen one, but the chosen one? In short, who are we to insist that the story of Christ, his birth, his life, his dying, his rising, who are we to insist that that story ought to be of interest even to those who are not interested, but who would rather see it as the private concern of that odd group of people who call themselves Christians? What our postmodern world seems only too happy to say to us is that we're fully entitled to our story, our way of construing the world. But please don't presume to inform us that your story is actually anything more than one story among countless stories, all of them worth hearing, perhaps a few of them worth pondering more deeply, perhaps a few of them worth making one's own. But none of them stories entitled to regard itself as holding pride of place ahead of any of the others. Or as it's sometimes put in the fancy language of postmodernity, there's no master narrative, no unifying story, only lots of different little stories. Well, on this baptism of the Lord Sunday, on this Sunday when we're privileged to catch a glimpse of the heavens opening upon Jesus as he rises from the waters of the Jordan, this Sunday when we may well see the shadow of that dove descending, this Sunday when we may even hear an echo of God's voice proclaiming Christ as the, not as a, but as the beloved Son with whom God is well pleased. On such a Sunday, we may be especially well positioned to recall why it is that we Christians cannot lightly relinquish either the particularity of the story we tell about this Jesus, nor its universal implications. In part, that has to do with the fact that the Christian story is the most foundational thing we Christians have to offer the world. While it may be true that the great Eastern religions are filled with wonderful stories as well, at bottom, what religions like Hinduism, Buddhism, and Taoism above all offer are profound religious philosophies, undergirded by remarkable contemplative practices. As for the other two Western religions, we Christians, unlike observant Jews, no longer follow the law code found in the Old Testament, nor have we embraced the law code found in the Islamic world. In short, neither our philosophies nor our practices fundamentally define us as Christians. Many philosophies have been inspired by the gospel story, and many faithful practices have evolved in response to the story. Those philosophies may help to clarify the story's meaning. Those practices, such as prayer, worship, generosity, those definitely help to bring the story to life, to make it credible. But neither philosophy nor practice are a substitute for the story. A story grounded in the particular life of a particular human being, the chosen one, if you please, born in the midst of a particular people, the chosen ones, if you please, chosen at a bare minimum precisely because it would be through their story that the story of the chosen one would burst forth. And that particular story, set in a particular time and place amongst a particular people, is of interest precisely because it burst forth beyond the bounds of one people in order to speak to other people. in order to speak to all people. And so, yes, as much as it may seem presumptuous for us to regard the story of Christ as somehow the world's story, it would seem even more presumptuous for us to regard it as a story that only applied to us and to ours. After all, as far back as the call of Christ's distant ancestor Abraham, God made it abundantly clear, and this is something neither Jews nor Christians should ever forget. God made it abundantly clear that Abraham and his tribe were called to be a blessing to all tribes and all people, a point the prophet Isaiah reiterates with particular emphasis with his insistence that his people were called to be a light unto the nations, something John's gospel applies quite specifically to Christ, who is designated not as a light, the light of a tribe, or the light of the church, but is the light of the world. That we Christians have sinned grievously when we've offered that light arrogantly or abusively or at the point of a gun, God help us. It is also something we dare not forget. That does not change the fact that we also err when we withhold that light, when we hide it under a bushel, when we treat it as our private possession. That light, the light that shines in the darkness, the light that the world has managed never to extinguish, that light still shines. And for better or worse, you and I are meant to share it where and when we can. Make no mistake about it, that light is offered for each. That light is offered for all. Permit a final thought. I teased earlier about the fact that we are singing Christmas music 1 week past the time when we officially ought to be singing it. But one of the really wonderful things about our celebrations of Christmas is that we tend to schlock together. If you were here last week and looked at that manger scene, that was a perfect example of schlocking together the story of Christmas from Luke's gospel with the story of Christmas from Matthew's gospel. While the purists remind us that they are two very different stories, and they are. What's wonderful about the bringing together of those two stories is the way in which they bring together Luke's shepherds with Matthew's wise men. The shepherds, local shepherds, presumably Jewish shepherds, busily watching their flocks in the hill country of Judea, they represent the particularities of the tradition into which Jesus was born. By contrast, the wise men, foreigners, traveling from distant lands, they represent the undeniable fact that the particular story of Jesus and his people became a story with universal implications for each and for all, with the promise of rich blessing, richest blessing, unsurpassed blessing for each and for all. May it be so in the name of the one on whom the dove descended, in the name of the one through whom the Spirit was set free. Thanks be to God.